This is Screen Divers. In this week's episode, we are talking about an immortal classic, The Conversation, 1974, directed by Francis Ford Coppola, written by Francis Ford Coppola, produced by Francis Ford Coppola, and starring Gene Hackman, John Cazale, Alan Garfield, Cindy Williams, Frederick Forrest, Harrison Ford, Michael Higgins, Elizabeth McRae, Terry Garr, Robert Shields, and Robert Duvall. This movie has a running time of 113 minutes. It was made for a budget of $1.6 million, and it made $4.9 million. It is the product of American zoetrope, and it is an American classic. How are you guys?
I'm good. I really enjoyed watching this with you last night.
It was good.
Yeah.
You don't have to thank me. You got to thank Ricky for this one.
Hello, guys. I do apologize if in this episode my voice either crackles or becomes unlistenable because I am fighting a cold.
That's all right. That's all right, man. It's a sexy voice. It's fine. We're like your gravel. Before we dip into this one, a quintessential question must be asked. Ricky, what is this movie about?
Picture San Francisco, picture the most boring-looking guy you've ever seen. Try and imagine what his job is. That's right, he listens to other people's lives. Does he have a life of his own? You'll never know. Welcome to the world of The Conversation.
That's the movie in a nutshell. However, I have a theory that this was your facetious attempt to take a jab at me. And I'll tell you why. You're a genius. You're a fucking evil genius. Because I said to Steve, yes, Steve, he is, man. I'm telling you, that's what we're friends. This guy's a fucking villain, dude.
I'm raising my eyebrows.
He will be regarded as the sick Lex Luthor, for sure. Like, I'm telling you.
With beard and actually a full head of hair.
Yes.
Unlike you.
They should recast him. They should recast, what's his name? What's the guy? What's the name of the new Lex Luthor?
The new one. It's, it's not Powter. It's the other one. Ah, the guy from that terrible film.
English guy from Renfield.
It's not Powter.
Powter.
It's not William Powter.
It's the other one. No, it's not him. It's the other English guy. Yeah, anyway.
Nicholas Holt.
Nicholas
Holt.
Got
it.
Yeah, they should recast that role and put you in there, man. I'm telling you.
What a roundabout way of getting...
Well, you know, I actually subconsciously did that because my favorite Lex is Gene Hackman. So there you go. I kept going on and on and on about it yesterday while watching this movie. From the beginning, I kept saying, I haven't seen this in its entirety. And then right after Steve left, I flashbacked. I actually watched this movie and did not pay respect to it. I went to see it in Melbourne when I used to live in Australia. I went to see it at the Prince Charles, not the Prince Charles, well, the equivalent of the Prince Charles, which is it's a really old theatre in Melbourne, seminal, like, old theatre, fantastic acoustics, and they turned into a picture house. I went to see Clockwork Orange in there. I went to, because they do reruns, right? And The Conversation was one of those. I went with my friend Pepe to see it. And it was a time in my life, I was in my early 20s, we used to get fucked up. We used to alter our minds and go and see movies. And this one went right over my head. So I completely forgot about it.
Was it the Thornbury? Or was it the NGV? The Arto?
No.
Oh,
it's
wow.
The I'm Astor just... Cinema. That's what it was called. Astor. The Astor, I think.
Astor.
I'm pretty sure. Double check, just in case some of our fellow Melbournians are listening to this. Melbourneites.
Well, the other Melbourneite I know is upstairs at the moment because she...
Okay, well, there you go. I love that city. Anyway, it went right over my head and I flash back to, oh, God, I've seen this. But I might as well not have seen it. Not with the eye that I had on last night. This was... Man, after... Hot Shots and Judgment Night, and it was so good to go back to film. It was like,
cinema.
Oh my, the cinema. Yeah, this is a proper film. And to our listeners, if you have not seen it, I can tell you right away that we are recommending this, all of us, collectively. And put your patient hat on. Give this movie 15 minutes to reel you in, and you will be rewarded immensely.
I would actually contend that. And the reason why I'd contend that is because the first 10 minutes of this film is intense without anything happening. It's so intense.
Absolutely.
I'm just going to step in here and say that I was drawn straight into this movie because of the audio design.
We're going to get to that.
Yeah.
Because until now, if you overlook this movie, it's because this is one of the practical examples of a movie that needs to be treated. Simply because technology is where you want it to be for this movie to give you the payoff that it needs to give you because of its audio design. It's all built around the conversation that's been recorded, and the sound is phenomenal.
Mm.
Now it is. Studio Canal, it's out there. Wherever you are in the world, you can either go and get a physical copy, or you can... We're not getting paid by Studio Canal, nor Amazon, Amazon Prime, Amazon Video. But if you, and you are very likely to have that evil Amazon subscription, if you do have it, go and get at least a 7-day trial for Studio Canal, add it to your thing, watch its movie. Because the UHD version that is streaming right now deserves your time. If you ever laid eyeballs on anything that made you feel something, watch this movie. The sound design is phenomenal, as Steve pointed out earlier, and you did as well. Now, why do I think that you are Lex Luthor? Because there's one thing, when this movie went over my head, the central point of the plot here is him editing three sound sources, which is what I have to do every time I edit this fucking show. So every time I saw that console with ABC and asked Steve, I turned around to Steve and went, he's a motherfucker, isn't he? And he goes, what do you mean? Gene Hackman's like, no, Ricky. He's like, what are you talking about? He's a piece of shit, dude. It's like, what do you mean? It's a compliment. I'm saying he's a piece of shit. That's a compliment. What do you mean it's a compliment? You're calling him a piece of shit. Like, no, I'm doing that affectionately. I love the guy. But that's why we're friends, because he's fucking doing this. And it's like, what do you mean? Well, the main character's obsessing over basically three audio sources.
Over
he's
A, B, putting and
them
C,
together.
Yeah.
You're a fucking piece of shit, man. Because if I had a physical console with knobs that I had to tweak, all right, they would be called U, S, and R. All right. This movie fucked me from
beginning
to end.
Did you learn anything?
I hope you did.
And the thing is, at the same time, I am the one.
You got to put B up more. That's what you should have learned. Blown up B.
There's the moment in which he goes, all I care about is that big fat recording. It's not what's been said, it's how it sounds. That's the point of this fucking podcast. But anyway, I don't know what happened to my balls there. I went really high pitched. I don't know.
Jeez. All right. Shall we talk about the intro shot? The intro
Yes, we should. Fuck me.
The one thing.
I mean, just wait a second. You structured the script. I never appreciated that. Because do you know how unusual it is? There's a reason why this is one of the greatest American movies ever made.
Yeah, I was going to say, actually, the intro shot, as much as it was written in, was a little bit of a crapshoot, because they actually asked the editor, Walter Munch, on set, how long should we have this shot for? And he just shouted out an arbitrary number.
Hey, this movie's edited by two people. You know what their names are? It's got to be a joke, right?
Yeah. What, Munch and...
Do you want to know? Walter Munch and Richard Chu.
Yeah.
Munch and Chu.
Yeah. But it's also... What's funny about it is that basically Munch was the supervising editor. So it's basically he was the guy who said, no, we'll do this, we'll do that. But what I find really interesting is that he just shouted out an arbitrary number. And it doesn't feel like that. Because whatever's being played, and again, it's all because of his design, Munch's design, whatever's being played, because he's also the sound guy, it all matches so well. As the zoom goes in, all the conversation, the parts of the conversation that you're meant to hear, or the little staticky bits that you're meant to hear, actually work with the zoom in on the annoying mime character.
Yeah.
if this movie is a... I told you, like, I had to put that monocle on last night. I had to put that monocle on because we got lost in this sea of bullshit about movies that we all dearly or we hate dearly. I forgot about why I love this medium, and it just, you really picked it right, dude. You picked it right. It's I needed that palate cleanser. I really needed that palate cleanser last night, and I went to bed right after watching it. I kicked everybody out. Steve was here. Mari came over, and I'm like, fuck our friendship. Get the fuck out. Get out. I need to process this. I love you both, but not now. This is for me now. I need to process this.
Maybe I shouldn't pick the films if this is the reaction you're going to have. You're going to lose friends, man,
shit. I'm telling the truth, man. Honesty is the currency these days. All right? I love him. I wanted him out. The power went out. As soon as this movie ended.
They're listening. Yeah. They're listening.
Yeah. Holy shit. And also, because we are talking about the editing and that, the opening sequence. It's beautiful. It's such a beautiful set piece that kind of sets the tone for what's a beautiful puzzle into paranoia. All right? This is a character study, and it is, what if the character that Bob Geldof played in The Wall was actually a little bit more cerebral and not just compulsive drug taker? Because that's what this is. It is a descent into paranoia, and it's such a beautiful portrayal of that at a time in which the country, the U.S., was in the grip, in the midst of this. You know, 1974 was released 2 years after Watergate, dude. This is, like, again, and not to quote, well, I will quote what happened, but I heard the story secondhand, you know, like, obviously growing up, it's part of history, like, it's... You can say that some of American history is global, and yet again, it became much more poignant after I heard Louis C.K. utter this. As I don't forget that when Nixon resigned, with these words, we watched the President of the United States resign, jump in a helicopter and disappear, cry and disappear. And that's exactly what happened. This movie, believe it or not, it's more current now than it's ever been. I can't wait to talk about the end of this movie once we get there.
Yeah,
it's not just the execution, guys. This is one of those movies that, believe it or not, and I don't want our listeners to think that, okay, just because we covered, you know, movies that we can chuckle about, and we don't treasure these. But this one somehow fell through the cracks for me, for whatever reason. I never watched it with the attention required to really get the payoff.
So coming back to that, I can remember, one of my comments was, I can't really remember this movie. I can remember there was something to do with a guy with a hearing aid, and then we get introduced to the guy with a hearing aid at that point. And I was just like, yeah, you know, I remember watching this on TV. I think it must have been BBC or something like that, going back in the 80s. And it's kind of stuck with me as a vague memory, but I haven't seen it since then. And I mean, like, it's almost Hitchcockian. It's got that really deep feeling to it. When we look at the characters and the character arcs in this, it really is that loner who's like forcing themselves deeper and deeper into this conspiratory kind of feeling. And it's amazing.
It
absolutely
is
amazing.
It is. It is definitely a descent as well.
Yeah.
Like, the character arc leads to like a... It does. There's no... How can I put it? There's a very emphatic point made at the end of this movie, by the way. Very emphatic. And yeah. And also, if anyone tried to do something like this with this many symbolisms in it, it would come across as heavy-handed, and this one isn't.
No.
It's the pacing of this is so... But yet again, it almost feels... There's a couple of times when I thought, is this didactic? Am I watching something that is trying really hard to be experimental? No, this is a magic trick. And the thing is, okay, we're talking about Francis Ford Coppola, and please, social media has fallen into this trap lately. People that, you know, younger people, obviously, they didn't have, and I'm not putting it on them, okay? Because at the end of the day, you're a product of your environment. I remember the comments about, and that includes us, obviously, at our age. We're only pushing 40. So, and I, if anything, I don't point, I try not to point the finger at the younger generation going, you're fucking stupid or you're a tasteless asshole. No, you're not. And if anything, and it's not pity. I really feel bad, and it's not pity. Just, I think you've been robbed. So if you are lucky enough and you're part of this younger generation to somehow meet somebody that points you in this direction, it's a gift they're giving you. And it's a gift you deserve. You really deserve it. And it's not that these times are devoid of any cultural value or weight when it comes down to fiction or anything that resembles art. You've just been robbed. That's it. It's not even your fault. Your mind is open. And I'm telling you, if you happen to, because I looked at the demographics for our podcast, I looked at the reach, I looked at who listens to this. The people who listen to our podcast are in their 40s. It's us. True. But for some reason, if you stumbled on this and you're listening to my words and you managed to decode whatever the fuck I'm saying, even through a thick accent, just know that we know and we feel for you. You've been robbed. So go watch this. Put your fucking phone in the bin.
Especially the 23 one-star reviews on IMDb. We feel for you. We understand your pain. You're being robbed.
Oh, fuck you.
In fact, I would even say that Francis Ford Coppola robbed himself with this movie. Because he's turned around. And the fact that this is slammed between Godfather Part 1 and Godfather Part 2.
And Rain People. Didn't,
yeah.
And 69.
Then, when we look at the Oscars for that year, he won with the Godfather Part 2.
Yeah, he's competing against himself.
It's himself.
That's a big dick swing, isn't it?
That is a very anyway, big dick swing.
The point that I failed to make at the end of that little statement was this. Social media. I remember the entire kerfuffle about one comment from someone like Scorsese. I was like, why the fuck are we talking about Scorsese? I was like, actually, it is relevant. Because you got to remember that the production company that we mentioned earlier, American Zoetrope, was comprised of the legends that some of you still idolize today. And that is George Lucas. That is, on the outskirts, Brian De Palma. That is Scorsese. That is Spielberg. That is... And the list goes on and on and on. And when somebody of this generation goes on social media and goes, oh, Scorsese is an asshole, and they make fun of him for whatever comment he made about today's entertainment feeling like a roller coaster ride. First of all, the tone makes the music. My mom fucking used to say that, okay? You're applying your own fucking tone when you criticize that statement. You don't know how that was said, but if you take tone out of it, factually speaking, he was 100% correct, and there is nothing wrong with that, because it's entertainment. However, that's not to say that it's completely devoid of artistic value, but it is just that. It is a statement, and it's pretty fucking factual. So, when someone like Coppola goes out of their way to fucking sell their house once again or throw all of his fucking money at something, you fucking praise that. No matter how bad it is, you praise that. Because that, just like this movie and the theme behind this movie, it's an obsession. And you can decide to watch it, not to watch it, whatever. But before you point the finger and criticize somebody, think about what's fueling that. Because this is a fucking artist. Regardless of the output. That's it. And that's me. Sorry. I had to fucking say this because I had to say it. It inflames me, man. It really irritates me. Every time I read stuff like this, people that know nothing about this medium just go on social media going, oh, the movie was shit. It's like, okay. Again, you said in another episode, Ricky, you said the loud majority. It's cacophonic,
well,
dude.
Sorry, no, the loud minority.
The loud minority. Yeah. There you go, sorry.
It's the smallest amount of us who seem to have the largest voices. I expect you to finish your your whole speech and everything.
I'm done, mate. No, sorry. It was a rant. It wasn't a speech, it was a rant.
This rant, then. I want this edit. This is a live editing choice. I need the theme music for talk radio just as you finish. Okay.
You know. Oh shit, was that?
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. I was expecting you to be shot in the parking lot later on as well. So,
dude, I'm not putting this on. This shit. Oh shit!
You're gonna do it again. know. The first scene. Anyway, what I love about this film is that the setup to this whole film comes down to the first 15 minutes of this film. Yeah. One of the things that is so amazing about this is that it keeps referring back to this one 10-minute sequence where this couple is walking around this very busy square where everybody's out for their lunch, and this group of surveillance crew, company, whatever they are trying to get their conversation over saxophones playing, over people just talking, them constantly moving. And it is just such an amazing thing to watch and witness when a script this tight can continue to make one element of its script the main subject for the next, like, 2 hours. What I find really great is that also there's some magic and trickery going on, because, of course, we're always made to believe that we're hearing the same conversation said in the same way over and over again. And the magic and trickery is that actually there are 4 or 5 different versions of this conversation, because there's a different intonation or emotion being presented in different sentences throughout the film. And on multiple rewatches, there's some obvious points where you will suddenly realize, oh my God, like the way she said, I do think about those guys all the time. Or the way he says, who started this conversation? There's slightly different emphasis throughout the words. And the reason for that is because, from my personal point of view, this film is about a narrator. This film is about somebody who slowly becomes an unreliable narrator. That's my version of the film, but then I've actually done some deep dives, which I'll talk about later on. But for my adolescent brain, when I first saw this film, the thing that blew me away the most was the fact that, oh my goodness, we are following somebody we can't trust. And it's, you only get that towards the last act of the film.
Yeah.
For me...
But it's not malicious, right?
It's not malicious. There's nothing malicious about it. But what's so fantastic about it is that as an audience member, this is a... As much as people talk about roller coasters and films and roller coasters, this is a ride. This whole film is a good,
absolutely,
decent ride.
And there's symbology about that particular word you mentioned just now, ride, by the way.
Right.
Yeah. There's another thing as well, which is another angle that I never... kind of, and this is just my take, all right? Tell me if you think I have a point here. It's uttered, because Coppola is a fucking genius. if he intended what I think, and it was intentional, then this is such a fucking, it's mind-blowingly complex. And again, it's like what an illusionist would do. The entire point of the conversation, and we are kind of given some hints that would push you in that direction, yeah? But then there's a lot of misdirection as well in the actual plot of this movie. When it comes down to the conversation itself, if you take your eyes, and you will, because that's the way the movie's constructed, you take your eyes off who's, like, for example, let's talk about who's the aggressor here and who's the smartest party. Because Harry Cole, which is Gene Hackman's character, gets taken for a ride from the get-go. My opinion, the moment this couple, this scheming couple, who is the real villain of this movie, by the way, realizes that they've been spotted, their conversation and the content of it, not even the tone, but the content, changes. The moment they get spotted, plan B comes into action. I never thought about this until last night. And they go, okay, you're recording this? I'll make sure that whoever you're giving the recording to gets to them. I will pay off the person that will make sure that it gets to them. And we will get that person exactly where we want them. That's the thing. And I have never noticed this. I have never noticed that the moment they get spotted, not only it looks like, oh, okay, we're being recorded. And then there's a part of the conversation that the guys cannot pick up. The three sources cannot pick up. And that part of the conversation is, we're talking about this now, just follow me. And it is the fucking hotel room. It is where, you know what I mean? Like, because that's... Their plan was not only to get one over the director, but to get him into the hotel room at the end of the movie. And that, to me, the fact that Henry Cole doesn't pick up that now it's no surprise because he actually, it's in the script, the character turns around to John Cazale, which is the closest thing that Harry calls his fucking friend. And he realizes this later, right? Yeah. He says, I don't care about what's being said. I don't care about what's being said. I care about how it sounds because it's for the client. And the last time he got too involved about what he heard and the content of it, that led to people being murdered.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, and there's so many fucking layers to this movie. And it's ambiguous. The ending itself is very ambiguous. You know, there's the other thing, like, sorry, let's jump to the end for a moment because we're not going to talk about the end itself. But from a visual standpoint, and it's no surprise, but just reminded me of the overhead shot in Taxi Driver. And I'm talking about the camera panning left to right at the end, like a security cam, right? Yeah. That, I don't believe that's imaginary. I believe that that's something Harry installed in his apartment after he saw that equipment at the expo and after he wanted to deter his landlord from coming in and giving him a fucking bottle of wine every day. So he installed it. But it is also so poignant. It is so poignant. Because this leads me back to the point that maybe I was trying to make earlier about today. And the fact that you may gather information for yourself, or you think it's for yourself, or you may even dismiss the fact that you're doing it yourself, that you're gathering all this data, all this stuff on that social media, and you're completely dismissing that somebody else can use that against you.
Who watches the
watchman? He was afraid of being monitored through the phone and this and that, but that camera has been there all along, and he installed it for a different reason. You know what I mean? It's this fucking movie, dude. I, you know, at one point when we saw the dream sequence in this, I fucking went, mate, fucking Ridley.
Yeah.
Ridley looked at this. You know, that beat that he took out of Blade Runner, it's because it was probably too on the nose. That entire dream sequence with the smoke that you see, it's the dream sequence with the fucking unicorn in Blade Runner. And it was so similar visually, down to the grain on celluloid, dude, that I thought he took it out. It's two brothers, man. Guess what? Guess who directed Enemy of the State with Gene Hackman?
Yeah.
Tony Scott.
Yeah, Tony Scott. Yeah.
And I had to go and check. Like, is this like a spiritual successor to this movie? It probably is because I remember that that character reminded me of a weather-beaten Harry Cole.
Yeah, so I did a bit of a deep dive on that. And there's a lot of Reddit threads, everything else, basically saying exactly the same situation.
That it's him. Yeah. That it is Harry.
Yeah. But obviously different
disgraced
name.
Disgraced again. Moved again. Changed his name.
Yeah. But completely different director. But, you know, it and the fact that in any movie state, they use footage from this movie to represent the younger version of Gene Hackman.
Really? Which,
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
So it feels like a spiritual successor.
But it wasn't stated by anybody in the productions. It was actually Kim Newman, the film critic, who said, "Oh my God, look at this, connected to the..." And of course, not many... Even though this was Oscar nominated, this is sadly another one of those films that kind of only gets brought up by film critics nowadays. It's not Not many people go, Gene Hackman, the conversation. No, most people say Gene Hackman, French the juror. What do people say Gene Hackman nowadays? What is the...
Nowadays, the fucking Royal Tenenbaums, dude.
Oh, yes.
It's phenomenal. Yeah. Tenenbaums. You want to talk some jive? You want to talk some jive?
Yeah.
It's fucking great in that.
Maybe...
Heartbreakers, like nowadays, maybe, although it was 20 years ago now.
Maybe the... The Unforgiven. But, of course, French Connection. Oh, yeah. French Connection will always be the burning heart.
Yeah, there's Mississippi Burning. I mean, I'm a huge Jackman fan.
No, but I'm saying
Jackman.
Nowadays.
Hackman. Sorry, I'll take that out. I'm a huge Gene Hackman fan, dude.
Like, you're a Jackman, I heard.
No, Gene Hackman. Are you going to stop fucking my head in, man?
You can't forget the classic Ants.
And yes, he was in Ants as well, yes.
He was?
he was in Ants. And in Absolute Power.
Is that the one with the main ant is fucking Sylvester Stallone?
No. Hold
the phone.
Is that
the one with the main ant is Sylvester Stallone?
The main ant is not Sylvester Stallone. The main one's Woody Allen. But yes, Sylvester Stallone's like second in command in the list. Yeah,
So this means that Woody Allen and Stallone were in the same movie, and people never think about that until now.
Woody Allen, Sharon Stone, Gene Hackman.
But actually, yeah. I did think of another Gene Hackman film that comes to my mind before any other ones, which is The Birdcage. There we go.
The man's
a legend, dude. The man is an absolute legend. The way he died is so fucking undignified.
Man, you know,
that apparently it was a rat infestation in his house.
Mm.
And the photos that I've seen of him, which is always like, I wish they would never release shit like that. It's just him and his wife were isolated. They were in isolation. Like, it seems to me that at some point he realized that he couldn't perform as an actor and pulled away into obscurity. The same thing is happening to Jack Nicholson, dude.
Yeah.
It's, you know, when you retreat, and it's these people should be celebrated until the end of time. I was also glad that you picked this movie just to sing his praises, dude. He's a legend, you know.
He is.
Absolute legend. Apparently he was not an easy man to deal with at all.
Well, even on this set, because of the short shooting schedule, because Francis Ford Coppola was about to go on to Godfather Part 2 very quickly, they only had 40 days to do principal photography.
Wow.
There was no reshoots, there was none of that. And so Gene Hackman felt like this character he couldn't get a real hold of. He couldn't understand. Especially he felt that it is like almost a complete opposite to who he was at the time. And there's even on the Studio Canal 4K that I own, there's a snippet of a behind the scenes from back in the day. It's only 8 minutes long. But there's a scene where even the narrator of that goes, Gene Hackman is finding it quite difficult to be part of this character. And it shows a scene where Francis Ford Coppola and Gene Hackman have this very heated conversation about, why am I looking at these pictures right now when I'm at a social gathering with these other people? Why am I disconnecting?
He's looking for motivation as an actor, which is fucking completely...
It's great and all that stuff. But what I mean is that his difficulties on set are probably coming from a point of, I need to nail this. And that is one thing I'll say about all Gene Hackman films. No matter how middle of the road they are, how family friendly they are, or how disturbing they are, especially with the Western films that he did, he always hits the character he's meant to be very hard.
But you know what? If Coppola did this and manipulated this just like Kubrick, and that's, you know, that's not to commend or to admire, because it is manipulation on set. These people are at work at the end of the day, and I get it. So, but at the end of the day, the final product is fucking art, okay? If Coppola did that intentionally, he's a fucking genius. Because that level of the perplexity and the existential crisis almost as an actor in trying to find out motivation works for this fucking character.
Mm-hmm.
You can see it on screen. It's palpable. It's palpable. You can see Gene Hackman continuously being in a crisis with his faith. You know, he's in this constant state of mistrust for everything around him. And I'm wondering if Coppola had this real desire to really channel what was going on at a social level for an entire fucking country. Because he did this and he just channeled it. He just honed it. It's like a magnifying lens is put right in front of it and it's just a laser, dude. It's this movie over and over reiterates to you that this, he doesn't give his phone number to anybody. I don't have a phone, he lies about it. To his employer, to his friends, to his girlfriend. He doesn't trust anyone over and over. He can barely bring himself to tell a priest in a confessional what's going on. And at the end of this movie, again, it's rife with symbolism. The entire moment when his obsession really takes over, he smashes this statuette made of rubber of the Madonna over and over again, because something he held dearly and respected doesn't matter anymore. Nothing matters anymore. What matters is, am I right? Am I wrong? Is this happening? And if you go online, you guys have been, Steve, you watched a couple of documentaries.
Yeah.
Ricky, you've gone on to Reddit and whatever. And I just fleetingly this morning, and just one of the first things I looked at, people were so focused on the ambiguous ending, right? Which is, is he in a complete state of delusion? It's like, possibly not. But the idea is that some of it is obviously delusional. the entire end sequence with his imagination spiraling and just going into overdrive about what has happened. It's there for a reason. You can't take it literal at a literal level, because that's not what this movie. This movie is more of a mother.
The best better go bugger and get this in the West.
But yeah, it's like my postie has come from six different dimensions. Wait a moment.
Man, he's going for it today.
Yeah.
It's fine. I think actually, if anything, that was a sign. It's like, stop fucking ranting. I'm sorry, guys. I'm steamrolling you as well. I'm not doing that in a... There's no ego behind it. I'm just really excited. I'm sorry. You should get to go rant yourselves, please.
So I just wanted to point out, because obviously we're talking about the priest in this section, where it's actually an uncredited part by Richard Hackman, Gene Hackman's brother. Yeah.
Yep.
Dick Hackman.
Dickie Hackman.
But also the boy in the church is Giancarlo Coppola.
Yeah. Now, is Giancarlo Coppola the one who passed? I can't...
I believe... Oh.
I'm more concerned with any of these people being Nicolas Cage's father.
Yeah, well...
Because he is...
Yeah.
Yeah, Nick Cage is Coppola's nephew.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
So, no. Look at Nick Cage's father.
Is it Gino?
Giancarlo?
Giancarlo or Gio Coppola. But he passed
Ooh?
In...
Which Coppola?
So, alternative names. Gio?
Gio? What?
Gio?
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 This is a fucking PlayStation game. Oh, yeah. Who the fuck is Gio?
Okay, he's got an
the
alternate
Japanese
name.
Version of the Coppolas.
Yeah. Maybe, I don't know. Yeah. But yeah, he did pass in 86.
Right, okay. So the only reason I know that is because if you know anything about Roman Coppola is basically now the counterpart to Wes Anderson. Anything that Wes Anderson makes, there's a pass that goes through Roman Coppola. Roman Coppola was best known for creating music videos, as well as being the offspring
of... But who's Roman? Is this Francis' son?
Yep. Sorry, it's an offspring of Francis Ford
Sophia's
Coppola.
Brother.
Sophia's brother. But yeah, he is mainly a director, but at this time and place, he's the main producer and main co-writer of Wes Anderson.
I bet you that Francis is still putting money into Anderson's movies.
Oh yeah, for sure. Because like it's that Hollywood machine, isn't it? It's that whole, not even nepotism, it's just this is the sort of stuff we do out here.
I know, but I have this, if I would have to envision what you're talking to me, I could just see Francis lighting up a cigar and then just getting a bunch of money and just burning it. Just burning
in,
it.
In front of Wes
money,
Anderson?
Yeah. Give money to Wes Anderson, like, hey. You go, shh. Just burn the cash.
Like, if you can grab it and blow it out, it's yours, Wes.
Every time he lights a cigarette, just fucking $100 bill, just... No, chain smoking. I like Wes Anderson, dude. I love Wes Anderson, but yeah, these movies don't make money.
It is interesting that Roman Coppola has gone from being an outright director himself to basically being a producer and writer with Wes Anderson, because there's a lot of stuff that he directed in terms of music videos that he should be celebrated for. You know, it's going from the most recent stuff, like he did the Last Strokes video, the Adults Are Talking, which is a very weird video, which uses like robots as pitchers in a baseball game against the Strokes, to going all the way back to Revolution 909 by Daft Punk, Playground Love by Air. We've got Walking Contradiction by Green Day, Peaches by Presidents of the USA. And it's just interesting to see that he's kind of left that all behind and decided to just work on scripts, which is a very strong point about this film. However, there's a lot that was in the script because of the short 40-day filming that didn't make it. And so there was actually a point where Francis Ford Coppola had to turn around to Walter Munch and be like, I can't, like, here it is. Here's everything that we shot. Make something out of it. So it wasn't meant to be as ambiguous according to the script. And according to the contact sheets, the photos taken by the director of photography on the days of shooting, they actually filmed a lot of scenes that would make this film very, very standard thriller.
Yeah.
I actually do wonder if we should be praising more Francis Ford Coppola for this film, or should we be praising Walter Munch for this film? Because the cut that came out and is still the cut today is definitely Walter Munch, and it's that ambiguity. And it's that same thing with things like Blade Runner and things like Apocalypse Now, that if you look at the final product compared to, like, the director's cut, compared to the final cut that comes much, much later on.
There's fucking six or seven cuts of Blade Runner, including White Dragon,
I mean,
or whatever.
Apocalypse Now, there's now we're up to three different cuts of Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
And the director's cut, or Apocalypse Now Redux, was Francis Ford Coppola just throwing everything in. He just threw everything in. And the final cut is him going, some of that was redundant, so here, I've made a better film. And I feel like with this film that we should be discussing more the fact that Walter Munch saved this film.
Definitely. But before release, though, that's different, because this was the theatrical release.
Yeah.
The remaster that we got did something magic with the sound. Magical. Magical. Something that this movie required. And from a visual standpoint, yeah, it is pretty at times. Okay? And there's, again, this movie kind of didn't need it. I think the remaster really, really pays respect to the sound, which, like Steve said earlier, it's such a central point of this. The level of kind of the magnetic nature of this movie should come from that. That's from the sound design. And I'm glad that it got the treatment. Like, at one point, 2 minutes in, Steve goes, man, this sounds great. Well, actually, that's one of the things that I hated about this movie originally was the sound. And it's so central to it. And now it's fucking phenomenal.
When we look at the sound and the directional context for it, sitting on your couch with the speaker behind me popping in with the static, I was just...
Massage your brain.
Yeah, oh my God, this is great. This is probably some of the best redeveloped sound design from a movie that I've heard on a restoration.
Look, the closest thing that I can pay respects to when it comes down to this new remasters, we mentioned it in other episodes, was the remaster, the Synapse release of the Synapse, or Synapse, whatever you want to call it, release of Suspiria.
Oh, yeah.
It's a fucking magic trick. And it's funny that it was released alongside the version curated by Argento, while the version that everyone praises is the one curated by the cinematographer. And it's mind-blowing. The sound design in that is also incredible. However, there's one thing before I forget, and it's regarding the female presence in this movie. There are two stars here. One of them came back to mind later, but the first one was Terry Garr. When I was a kid, I always had like a soft spot for her. Well, a hard spot for her. and it's because of Frankenstein Jr.
Yeah.
And she was always memorable. It's like, to me, she's like a precursor as a character actor to the Arquette sisters, particularly Rosanna Arquette. But Terry Garr, and funnily enough, they were together in the movie that I'm about to mention, which was After Hours. In After Hours, she's so fucking memorable. We lost her. We lost her last year, by the way. Terry Garr died last year.
Yeah.
But she's not the eye candy in this. And I'm going to tell you something now. Like, the first impression that I've got from the actress in question, which is Elizabeth McRae, was not pleasant. When she comes on screen, she kind of looks cheap. There's something about her. But then the cinematographer did a little bit of magic here. He weaved this magic. Because there are sequences in this movie where look, man, there's an episode of Seinfeld which is all about this girl that Jerry's dating, and every time the light hits her differently, she goes from being very good looking to fucking horrifyingly awful. And that's the point of the episode. Any Seinfeld fan here knows the episode I'm talking about. This movie is an example of that. Because there's a moment in which the cinematographer managed to capture this woman's beauty. And it's at the height of the stratagem that is being pulled on Harry. This one sequence right before she kind of is so obsessed, and yet she manages to be the destruction that she was intended to be. But there's another symbolism in one sequence in a warehouse. That's a beautiful space, by the way where Harry and John Cazal work. Phenomenal. Any artist would pay through the nose for that space today. There's a sequence in which she's trying to seduce him. It's right after the party, kind of, right before the party goes turn sour, right after the expo. And there's a moment in which John Cazal jumps on his Lambretta or his Vespa and they start riding circles around him. He's literally being taken for a fucking ride.
Yeah.
And I hated that. I hated that because I loved it. But I hated where it took me mentally. Like, I started looking at Cazal's character going, and I said this to Steve. Steve, you remember, I said to you, did they get John Cazal to play another traitor?
Yeah.
Like, so quickly? It just doesn't feel right. And then I thought about it. It's like, it's not him. And there's another symbolism that kind of pulls you away from that. And I thought, what the fuck is this movie? What is this movie trying to do to me? In the sequence where John Cazal kind of starts picking up on how uncomfortable Harry is getting, because of, what's his name, Bernie? Yeah, Bernie. That guy plays a weasel so far.
So well.
He's so on point.
He's so on point. And we both confuse him for, I don't know, from an aesthetics point of view, he reminded me of the guy that goes, we don't serve fucking mooks in Main Street, but it's not him. Or the guy that sells toupees in Goodfellas, what's his name?
That's exactly what you thought it was.
And I said, yeah, you know, it's not the dude from Goodfellas. But it's one of those forgotten character actors. I thought we saw more. I was hoping to see more of him, right? But in that sequence, when Cazal steps in going, he doesn't say it, but it's almost like he enters the frame like, this is too much, guys. Mm. But he doesn't say it. He doesn't say anything. And he stands by a pillar. And before he hits the pillar, he hits his mark. There's a little mirror, and you see Cazal's refraction for a second, and I thought, he's not. The moment he hit that mirror, I thought it was so, like, I don't know. I thought the shot, again, man, this movie is rife with symbolisms. Like I said earlier, it's a very religious movie as well. Not just because of his beliefs. Didn't you think so?
Well, look, I mean, the one thing I would say about this film, before we start, like, you know, beating each other off... Fist overhand, overhand, like,
what the fuck did you say? Sorry, did he just say?
We're going to be cucking each other and all that stuff.
We're going to beat each other off?
Yeah, that's where we're getting to, by the way.
No, I'm beating myself. I'm beating myself off.
I'm taking my, hoodie off just to get my arms free and everything.
Are you feeling warm?
You beat me off.
Maybe a little bit hot.
You don't want me to beat you off?
No.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
I'll watch.
I read the signs wrong.
Jesus.
Just like Harry does through the middle section of the party. He reads the signs wrong. So, look, the way I saw this film when I originally watched it, which is now slightly different because I've read a lot around the original script and whatnot, is... the party scene is meant to be the point where it's sort of make or break for Harry. And the reason why I'm saying it's make or break for Harry is because his mental state is slowly becoming so obsessive that at the start of the party, he's actually starting to loosen up. He's actually starting to give a little bit of himself. Yeah. He's starting to think, maybe I am too obsessed with what's going on in my job. And then... he hits another point where he wants to boast. He wants to boast about how good he is. And he wants to show up Bernie. After Bernie's expo and him trying to do the telephone tap, he's just like, well, I've created stuff that you'll never get. And it's all set up by his work colleague, by Stan. Stan basically says, check this scene out. How would you do it? And Bernie can't get it. And this feeds Harry's ego. And it feeds Harry's ego to such an extent that when his ego gets broken, that is the point where the obsession is going to take over. He's done.
There's the subtlety as well. When he goes to his working desk, he picks up all of the plans and puts them behind a locked cage in the middle of the party. This movie's fucking hell.
A party.
But I really like the broken-hearted reaction from Stan at the end when he goes, man, basically Stalin is like, I thought you were a friend. What the fuck? Yeah. And he knows.
Yeah.
He knows. Because Gene Hackman, for a moment, is like, he goes, don't do this to me now.
Yeah.
I promise you, we'll deal with this later. I just can't. I know what you're saying to me, and you're right. He doesn't say it. It's like, it's so fucking emotionally charged.
My point is that the minute it goes into the dream sequence, now, of course, this has all been destroyed because if you go on a deep dive, you'll find out more about the dream sequence. When it goes into the dream sequence, that is the point I believe his brain has broken. That is the point where I believe the obsession has taken over. And then from this point on, we have the narrator that we've been following, the narrator that we know is super duper good at his job, who is the person that everybody should be going to for their surveillance needs, to the man who is so unhinged that he believes that two people are going to get murdered because of him. And then the rest of the movie is so unreliable that there's the point where he sees the toilet overflow blood is so surreal.
He's not unhinged though, dude. He's terrified. It has happened before to him.
But no. My point is that like the film is. This is what I used to think. I used to think that the film is a perfect.
But it's not because of.
It's a perfect representation of a visual, unreliable guilt, you know that, right? Narrator.
That's what the Catholicism here is paralleling.
Look,
like,
yes, I get all that, but what I'm telling you, my point of view from when I first saw this and why this has cemented itself in my brain as like one of the best pieces of cinema ever.
Because
I
felt you're saying you perceived it that way when you were younger.
Yeah, because I'm gonna blow my own theory out of the water. Because what I've read now, I now know that my perception.
Fuck what you read. Don't worry about what you read. I'm interested in your perception.
My original perception and the last time I saw it, which was two nights ago. Was
what the fuck? I thought you were talking about years ago. What the fuck?
No. Like two nights ago. Okay. My perception was that you hit that middle point and the narrator that you've been following that you believe is so professional and knows exactly what he's doing suddenly becomes the most unreliable narrator because the paranoia has kicked in.
Yeah.
The obsession's kicked in. Everything about this is totally like from that point you can't believe your eyes, you can't believe your ears, you can't believe anything going on. And it's such a perfect representation of an unreliable narrator. And then you come out the other end of it, where all these deeds have happened and he doesn't know how much he's had a hand in it, how much he's been like put on the, you know, he's been put on the wrong side or the right side, or who he was actually working for. Was he working for Harrison Ford's character? Was he working for Anne, the wife? Who was he working for? He doesn't even know, but it never gets explained. Now, I've said all of that, but let me tell you, none of that's right. And I'll tell you why none of that's right. There were three scenes that weren't included in the film that were in the script. You see the death of the director. Like, you see the murder of the director. Yeah. You see the cleanup and them putting the body in the car. And on top of that, there is another scene where, you know, the dream sequence?
Yeah.
That was meant to really happen. Harry's guilt and Harry's obsession takes over that he wants to put himself in the basically secure Anne, the wife. And so he goes to the park to find her and basically reveals himself.
That didn't fucking
happen. I know, exactly.
Whoever had it, this is a genius then.
Is where Mark was even at the park to come in and intervene and be like, I don't know what you're doing. We don't know who you are. And like, they make a sharp exit. So the fact of the matter is that I asked my previous question. As much as Francis Ford Coppola wrote this project, directed this project, it was Walter Munch who made the fucking film.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Hey, another thing as well, like, because afterwards, I was looking at this as well, not just, you know, there's an emotional charge running through the movie, and I, you know, you can't help but kind of internalize it a little. And I'm not surprised that this movie hit me now at fucking 48. Sorry, 42.
Sorry,
35. 44?
26. It's going to be believable, right?
12.
Fucking, am I love Buttoning myself.
We're trying to improve our demographic here, so 14.
Benjamin Button, isn't that Coppola as well?
No, that's David Fincher.
Yeah. Who is technically part of the American Zoetrope.
David Fincher.
Yeah, it's David Fincher.
Yeah.
Benjamin Button is David Fincher.
It's David Fincher. Which is why, like, the dark overtones of Benjamin Button.
Is it produced by Coppola?
Maybe. But, like,
well,
I can
it's
tell
kind
you.
Of relevant now, so.
Yeah, exactly. Benjamin. But it is David Fincher. Grasping. Because there's some dark overtones in Benjamin Button that no one talks about.
Grasping.
Like, especially
at
the end.
Straws. Benjamin. Wait a second, let me see.
Oh, wait, there was a quote from Francis Ford Coppola that said, "Watch this movie."
No, I found like a match on Google because there's two articles. One of them is about this movie and another one about Coppola. Okay, wait a second. It's got to be. Why do I think that he was involved somehow?
Because you trust your brain.
I shouldn't. Fucking you shouldn't either. Fuck it, whatever, man. It's irrelevant.
I'm going to look it up now.
Point of the matter. I started looking at this like a proper... I hate the word... I don't hate it, but it's just... Let's call it just noir. It's a noir tale. This neo-noir, it's been tossed around. You can put it in every decade, all right? When did noir stop being noir? Like, how far are we going back? Because, you know, after the 30s, everything is like neo-noir. It's like we stopped... having noir tales after the 30s. So let's not say a noir tale, okay? That's what this is. Yeah. And it is quintessentially quite pulpy as well. Two lovers. You know, it's like adultery. Like murder. Like, it is. It's not that complex. But here's the kicker. Stett. Martin Stett, which is played by Harrison Ford. You know, I would... He's got like a... There's kind of a queer edge to his character as well.
Well, he did... do this in the you go run with this
but anyway he's playing both fields in this because he originally worked for the director, but then he obviously took a fucking payout from them because he's working from them, and you're actually hinted at it, like you're given a hint when he enters the elevator. He gets a glance from Mark, Amy's lover, and from him. So ideally now he's working for them. He's not working for the director. It looks like he is, but that's it. He switched sides. And there's a moment in which he goes to Harry Cole at the end, he goes, $15,000, that's a nice payout. And what he's implying in my head, what I heard was, yeah, I got paid a little more than you. that's what I heard.
Yeah. But it's actually also said in the conversation between Anne and Mark that somebody said, one of them says, what if somebody finds out, oh, we'll just have to pay them. And that's what they do with Stett.
Yeah, but
you see,
this is the stuff I overlooked the first time I watched it.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that if, like, most people would have as well. Like, I didn't pick up on any of this. I wasn't paying attention. I was not paying attention the first time I watched
this. You
know
who else wasn't paying attention?
Hello.
I guess we're looking for one-star reviews. This one is by 46-year-old male. Well, he was 46 in May 17th, 2001, but maybe he made his account earlier than that. So he said, so this is what a classic is. As my 15-year-old son would surely say, what were they high on? do me. This is another sad sack 70s film where everything goes wrong at a snail's pace. You know what would have made this film better? If it was more of a documentary and the director just snuck around and taped Gene Hackman's real-life private conversations. Oh boy, that would be a hoot. I wonder what has said to the milkman, because they had milkmen back in 74, back in the golden age of classic filmmaking. Unfortunately, the director went another direction. And I have another fantastic one-star review.
Before you get to that, what was this guy's name?
He was a 46-year-old virgin, by the sounds of it. Oh, sorry, 46-year-old male from May 17, 2001.
Sorry, is that his tag? 46-year-old male?
Yes, it is.
I hope he got a fucking vasectomy, because he said he has a 15... That fucking guy reproduced. That's a fucking problem here.
I don't think it is.
You don't think it is?
I don't think it is, because compared to G.W. Mass, that'll do, pigs, that'll do. Did Orson Welles write this garbage? So, dragging down Orson Welles' names as well in your review. Interesting, G.W. Massey. This movie was so highly rated, I was kind of excited about watching it. Boy, was I disappointed. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war. That'll do, pig, that'll do. That is G.W. Massey, November 12, 2017. I am really sorry that I went into a Cockney accent there. It must be
fuck
for
that.
My new
role. You know
what?
Don't read a 10-star, because we don't need it, and I'll tell you why. Because that's us. So, anyway, whatever. I think it's time for ratings, almost. Unless, I know Steve is a little disappointed, but there were no guns in this movie.
No, there were no guns. But there were gun mics.
There were mic guns.
There was a mic gun.
Pew, pew, pew.
But it's custom, so...
Steve, have you got anything else to add to this conversation?
Kind of. There are a lot of things where, you know, the birthday card says 44th birthday. And that we get the Gene Hackman then basically turning around and saying 42 and that kind of stuff.
Do you remember kind what of we said to each other when he said that he was 44?
Yeah, he's trying to play. It's just...
There was an entire conversation that basically, the gist of it was, we fucking look so much younger. And I tried to justify it elegantly, not really, by saying, oh, it's the way we dress, for sure. It's the way we dress.
Yeah, yeah, if we were wearing like a suit every single day.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
But Steve, you want to dump a bunch of factoids? You got some stuff? You got some juicy stuff?
I do have a couple of little bits and pieces.
Go.
I didn't write them down, so I'm just having to scan really quickly.
How many screens are you glancing at? Six.
I've got three.
Fucking hell. It's at least double
One's an iPad associated. Four, anyway.
Can you do your top five, and then we can put the old Top of the Pops theme over the top?
Don't, I have to fucking
So, first one, basically, Harry's last name was supposed to be Call, C-A-U-C-A-L-L, but that was due to a spelling mistake on a where they put in C-A-U-L.
I thought that that was on the nose,
yeah.
Man.
So, it was a little bit on the call,
like
call,
right?
Which is, yeah. The original cut of a movie was 4 hours long.
Shit.
I would have watched that. I would have watched it.
That is a little bit too long.
You know the moment Bernie at the expo is giving the demonstration for his fucking bullshit device with the phone?
The harmonica.
The harmonica thing?
Harmonica man.
First of all, I couldn't help but think of Link in Zelda for whatever reason. And then for a moment in my mind... I put that dude in Link's costume, and I thought, what the fuck is this? Why am I doing this? But anyway.
So there was a reference to the Teamsters.
What was? John Polito.
There was a reference to the Teamsters in when they were having that discussion about Call's previous work. And they were talking about the Attorney General. And
but this doesn't happen at the expo. That happens at the party.
No, this is at
what
the
I'm
party.
Talking about... was my desire for that sequence to lead to an instance in which he did that, he gave the demonstration, And like there was a comic bit in the movie in which he hears his wife fucking another dude, like, you know what I mean? And
didn't happen.
It was a pre-recorded message, right?
Of course. Yeah.
But it would have been, because I wanted that guy shot down immediately. And funnily enough, and then I'll give it back to you, Steve, the moment we meet Bernie is right before the church encounter with Mark, which is the cop in this.
Yeah.
And I thought he was an ex-cop. No. He's in active duty still, and he takes the surveillance jobs on the side, right?
Yeah.
Which was a thing.
Yeah.
And there's a moment in which they meet in the church, and Gene Hackman looks up at him and goes, "Fuck, man, you look good. That's a nice suit." And he goes, "It's French." And then the next sequence, we meet Bernie, and he's dressed like a piece of shit.
Yeah. A 1970s car, like used car salesman kind of situation.
Orange pants, red jacket, awful. Now,
burgundy jacket, come on.
Mark, in the car, there's a moment in which we're going to talk about the car in a second as well, but they're in the car. He's in the police car, and he goes... he's kind of trying to show off in front of his friends, and it looks like an episode of The Office, man. Like, they're walking away from that expo like these guys have not an ounce of excitement in their life, which they do, but they're all like nerds basically, and all of a sudden they're hardcore, right? They're in the cop car, and someone with a charger, younger guys, are challenging them, and all of a sudden Mark, which is the cop, was driving in his cop car with everyone in the car. There's girls in there, there's like six of them. He abuses his cop powers to the max. He picks up his phone, which looks like we thought, is that a CB radio? No. It's one of the earliest car phones. And it's got like an actual old phone handset on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he calls in and he goes, "Can I have a 1028? And immediately I went to Steve, "What the fuck's a 1028? And I had to read it. Like, I don't know. To me, it was kind of interesting because I never knew what it was. Ricky, do you know what a 1028 is?
I'm guessing it's an identification of a dodgy assailant.
In police code, 1028 generally signifies a request for vehicle registration information. According to a police code glossary, this means an officer is asking for details about a vehicle registration, likely through a dispatcher or a database search. Hmm. Now, why are we mentioning this? Because that abuse of power has a little bit of comedic relief in this sequence. Because... right before he hangs up the phone, the guy, the dispatcher, goes, "Why do you need this information?" He goes, "Thank you. I just got the phone." That's it. Steve, okay. Back to you.
So, Gene Hackman actually learned to play the saxophone, especially for this film.
Good on him.
Yeah.
He did really well.
Yeah.
There's some really difficult jazz standards in that what he plays, and he killed it.
He really does.
Good. I mean, really like, so I think that's about five.
Okay. I'm going to come up with one that kind of soured the film a little bit for me.
Which one?
So I love this film. I picked this film. This film always has a memory. And then I read somewhere that Francis Ford Coppola saw Blow Up. No. Was it Blow Up?
Blow Out. 81. No, Blow Up is after, mate.
It's before.
Blow Out is Brian De Palma. Blow Up's the British one by Antonioni. Okay.
Yeah, but do you know that, is it Blow Up or Blow Up? The 81, the Palma one, is inspired by this movie.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Blow Up, Antonioni film, the British Antonioni film.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, oh, cool, it's just a pastiche and all that stuff. And then I remembered the mime scene in Blow Up. Now, the mimes appear at the very start of the film and the very end of the film. Mm. And then I rewatched the very end of the film where they do a tennis match against each other, and then they do those crazy, like, floor displays that ends the film. And then it just reminded me that the whole intro of this movie is that mime.
Yeah.
And it doesn't take away from it, but then you start, you start piecing together the parallels. Now, what Francis said about it is that he watched Blow Up and he said, how can I do it about audio surveillance and not about photography? And then you start seeing, he borrowed quite a lot from Blow Up. But yes, this film, if it wasn't for having Gene Hackman and having everything that happens with what he's surveilling, then it is a very different film. But yeah, there are those odd moments throughout this film that is very blow up.
Dude, we would be remiss if we didn't mention David Shire's theme in this movie. Mm. It is phenomenal.
It's so good.
Piece of beautiful music.
Mm. Yeah.
And several different parts of it are featured throughout the movie, but it's the same piece of composition. And it's called, which is so revealing, and I realize that now, Whatever Was Arranged. Mm-hmm. Whatever Was Arranged. It plays at the beginning of the movie, dude. So this movie's kind of taking the piss out of you as a viewer as well. It's like, here you go. And you know what I said to Steve right after we heard it? I stopped the movie and I went, here is me irritating you while we watch this movie, Steve. Basically without saying it. But I said to him, doesn't this remind you of something? And he goes, what do you mean? He goes, fucking Blood Simple. Do you remember those notes in different. Blood Simple? Yeah. It's not the same. They're not the same. Steve, was there like the,
There's quality? There's a quality to it, but it's this different. I am going to say that I've got a little bit of extra on this one. The music was already completed. Before the film,
and so it wasn't made for this movie. It was selected for this movie.
It was done for this movie, but it was already pre-completed prior to it going through.
Fuck, man, that's more Morricone's career you just described.
And I'm just going to turn around and say that before they got into
turn
the
around,
scenes,
though. You got to turn around first.
Turn around.
Every now and then I get a little bit lonely, and you're never coming around.
Turn around.
Every now and then I get a little bit tired of listening to the sound of my tears.
Turn around.
Every now and then I get a little bit
turn around, proud eyes.
So, before they got into each scene, they would play the piece of music associated to the scene to get them into the mood.
Nice.
Which is an interesting thing that I found on one of the documentaries.
Nice.
Which is really nice.
I also want to say that David Shire, if you don't know who he is, Taken of Pelham 1, 2, 3.
Which you mentioned in the previous episode.
President's Men. Mm-hmm. Saturday Night Fever, he had a few musical stings in it. And then even going up to recently, The World According to Garp. In the 80s, and the original Monkey Shines back in 88.
Yeah. So, more recently. He's older. He was, I think, because I took a quick look this morning, 1934. But then I didn't see the other date next to it, and I went, oh, he's still alive. But he's not working. Yeah. So he's alive.
He was the conductor of the Short Circuit.
Yeah, I saw that. I didn't want to mention it.
Short Circuit. Johnny Five is alive.
Can you never do a fucking Indian accent again? Can you?
Well, it wasn't really technically an Indian accent on Short Circuit either, was it? I am sorry, but Johnny Five is missing from the rest of the fleet.
Jesus Christ, dude. You get to do that, you brown person, you. Now, we all get a pass here, besides Steve, I think. I get to take the piss out of Italians myself. You get to take the piss out of that part of Southeast Asia.
He gets to take the piss out of Welsh.
Of Welsh.
Yeah.
Dude, I can make all the sheep jokes I want.
But everybody gets to do that. Are you white as
well? Well, no. No, yeah, because that's racism. Yeah. Casual racism, mate.
Yeah.
What is what?
The sheep jokes.
Are you upset? But are you fucking for real, dude? How many times does my how many times does the princess have to get fucking kidnapped?
By the way, Steve,
how many times?
Steve, I'm still trying to weigh up. I do love the Manic Street Preachers, and I'm trying to weigh up, like, you know, them coming over here to Australia. That. But the Stereophonics are coming out in October. Should I go see them?
Stereophonics, I put on one of their first gigs in Swansea.
Oh my god! That's how old you were?
It was pretty much 50 quid and a bottle of vodka.
And I fucking buy you a pair of Velcro gloves every Christmas.
While I went, God, again.
Oh my God.
That was a zone in Swansea. Yeah.
I think it's now times for ratings. Grab your pens. Write it down. It is time to deliberate. Write it down. Write the score for this movie down.
I really like thrillers. And I really like Alfred Hitchcock style movies. I'm drawn to them in a lot of different ways. The audio design in this movie, I gave an extra 2 points to, because it does really make this movie. It's a fantastic movie. I think this should be on everybody's watch lists. Some people like some weird guys on IMDb who give it 1 star should just be shot. But
very diplomatic.
Sorry,
Newton, dude. This should be fucking.
If you can't even give 1 star for the audio design in this, you're an absolute pleb. But I mean,
so what's the score?
Nine. Shotgun microphones.
I am so fucking glad you didn't steal mine. Don't say anything. And I'll tell you, the moment I say it, you're going to eat your hat that you're not wearing.
No.
Okay. This is one of those movies that, like I said, it rejuvenated me. I went to bed energized. I wanted people out of this house so I could revel in my enjoyment of this. I was tired, by the way. I was tired and I was feeling a lot by the end of it. Some people watch a movie like it's just entertainment. I find it's an all-consuming or all-regenerating activity, you know? Like, it's not just a movie. It's never just a movie. That's the thing. That's why it usually feels bad, because it's hard to come across something that it's really good. And if something is really good, we most likely have seen it. But every once in a while, you get this feeling. And it's even better when you get it with something just released, because it's even rarer. But I, like I said, thank you, Ricky. Thank you, Steve, as well, for coming over and watching it. It makes me feel like we need to go back and watch a lot of this wave of cinema from the 70s, which I actually remember very well. I almost felt bad towards this movie. I feel like I paid a debt that I owed this movie. Like, one of my favorite movies from, you know, it's on the verge of 70s, because it feels... It's Paris, Texas, and it's not a 70s movie. That's like almost mid-80s, but the thing is, it feels like a 70s movie. It's got that vein running through it, and I think Bendis did that on purpose, because it has a similar pacing and it has a similar payoff at the end that requires a listener to invest, which people don't really have to do this day. This movie is demanding. It demands something from you, and it will give you dividends in the end. It's like you're invested in something. You know what I mean? It's a sure shot, so do it. Do it. Invest in this. Invest your time in it. But I'm more than ready to go back to movies like Carnal Knowledge, like Five Easy Pieces, because I think you need to watch those movies as an adult. I think you need to have that baggage, that luggage full of fucking pain and scars to get it. You need to know a little bit more about life to pick up all the facets that this movie's showing you. You need to have been paranoid at some point. You need to have lost and gained. You need to have that for the movie to hit. Otherwise, you just don't have the right viewpoint to appreciate it. Does it make sense? And I'm not saying that, I lived an extraordinary life. No, I lived long enough to get it. And I think this movie, if you hit 40 and you watch this and you don't get it, fuck, man, you're either blissfully ignorant or you're very lucky, or you just... a fucking empty vessel and go listen to a different podcast. But if you're young and you suffered enough already, you get this one. If you lost yourself, you get this one. If you were ever in crisis, or you had you lost your faith, or you lost grasp of what's real for a fucking second because something rocked you enough, because that's what this movie is about. It's about doubt. It's about doubt that leads to something darker. This movie is a 9. And it is a 9 quintessentially 70s bottles of Chianti clad in wicker.
Given as a gift.
Yeah, Steve, I'm a piece of shit. Yeah,
No. I knew you were going to bring that up.
When that bottle came into frame, we all knew what the fuck it was.
Yeah.
You know, when you saw that bottle came, it's like, oh, what are those now, man? What are those? Ricky.
I always look at the films that I watched way too young, and I think to myself, you know, if I just waited 4 or 5 years, I would have got more out of this. I would have enjoyed this more. This film, when I watched it at 15, I was totally and utterly invested. And if it wasn't for films like this, and at the same year, that same
was
year...
Was it your auntie again?
No. This was a friend at school. Because a friend at school basically asked me to go to a restoration showing of Citizen Kane, and after we watched that, he said to me, if you really like that, and I know it's going to be slow, go watch The Conversation. And then I went and watched The Conversation in the same week.
We were all unbearable teenagers.
Yeah.
Unbearable.
Yeah. I know, but there's a lot of other stuff that I watched at that sort of age that I shouldn't have watched, and it's probably completely warped my mind, but I am so glad that I've put myself at 15 through this film. And it has made me understand what cinema and what film going should be like. It should be a dark room with everybody questioning what's going to happen next, or can I believe what I've just seen? This film is quintessential. I cannot wait till my kids are old enough to sit them in front of this, and no matter what their reaction is, I'll be like, and we're going to watch it again until you like it. What I find about this film is that no matter how many ways you look at this film, there's always a new way to look at it. This is exactly what this film should be like. Yes, yes, cops, CJD.
Social services are your fucking door, mate.
DCJ, as it's called in this country. This film is pure gold. I gave it 9.5. There's only a few things that I don't agree with this film, but I will sit down and watch this on repeat. I was ready to watch the commentary with Francis Ford Coppola as soon as I finished watching it off the Studio Canal 4K that I have. So 9.5 what? 9.5 hidden home telephones that no one knows about because I'm not giving you my number.
Nice.
You know that I'm not giving you, like, I don't have a phone kind of thing? It almost reminds me of, I have to return some videotapes from fucking American Psycho.
Yeah.
But people won't get that these days. People won't understand the fact that having a telephone was a privilege. In the home, you know, the idea of having to go to it. We were talking about the idea the last time we used a phone box.
Yeah. It's because he didn't want his fucking phone tapped. That's how paranoid the guy.
No, we but understand that. But
I think Steve's right. Even that earlier scene where he goes to a phone booth to make a call, a business call.
We had a conversation where we were basically saying, when was the last time?
The title of the movie.
Hey,
the fucking reflection in that shot.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Of everything around that phone booth. Fuck it, beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. Yeah. And what happened? What happened to those long shots in modern cinema? Mm-hmm. Like that slow zooming. Even there's a couple of tracking shots in this that are beautiful. Like,
in the first shot from the building of this film, I was going to say everybody in Glengarry Glen Ross would have been at like jumping out of their seats, being like, "That's not true," because he scores so many like women in this short film, and Jack Lemmon never scored a woman in Glengarry Glen Ross.
No, he was married, though. He was married. Yeah. Steve, you were saying?
When we look at the fact that this is all filmed in downtown San Francisco, which is basically the home of American Zoetrope.
Yes, it is. Anne, there wasn't really... She was not as invested in the movie as we were. At one point, she walks past the... She walks into the room and she goes, "Where are the heels? Where are the..." And she was right. The movie makes a point out of not showing you, like, quintessentially stereotypical San Francisco landscapes. It's like it doesn't want to do that. In fact, the only time we see like a San Francisco landmark, it's not even real. It's a painting that it's in the hotel room. It's in the hotel room, and he's glancing at it. It's tasteful, I think. Instead of having all this like heels and, you know, what would you call them? What would...
High rises? What? No, oh, yeah.
No, the streets. High streets. Yeah, the atypical.
No, but I keep saying heels. Like, what would you call them? Like, what's it called? When a road goes, it's
hilly
really
streets.
Like steep.
It's a hilly street.
Steepy streets.
Yeah.
Steepy streets?
Steepy
a
streets.
Steep street. My God, I can't believe we're just doing this.
Fucking hell, mate.
Steepy
but it's just, it's a beautifully shot movie.
And on that note, this was Umba.
This was Steve.
This is Ricky.